And Ruth said, Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return them following thee after, for whither thou goest I will go, and where thou lodgest I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. Welcome back to Bookwave. I'm your host Scott, joined by Pat.
Hey.
And Will.
Hello.
And today we're looking at the Book of Ruth in our Holy Bible book club. And my first question to you, being Ruth, the main character, what happened to her sister-in-law, Orpah? Because she doesn't get any lines. What do you two think happened to Orpah at the end of this first chapter?
I think that there's a good way to look at this, and I'm going to look at it through like the personal growth lens. So like Ruth is the metaphor for open-mindedness, opportunity-searching perspective. Orpah is the retraction to the comfort zone. And then Naomi and Mara are the reacting terribly to things perspective. So Ruth looks at this thing and says, you know what? I know where I came from. That's not good enough for me. I don't even care that there's no chance of a husband or a prospective future, because even with that in mind, it's still better than my people and my gods and my town. So I'm coming with you. And Naomi is like, I have nothing to offer you. I'm going to go home and die. And Ruth is like, that's fine by me. Like, let's go. I'm so excited to see your town. Orpah's like, I have a home. I have a family. And I'm going back there because I don't want to grow. And I'm comfortable with that. And I'm returning. And then it unfolds from there.
I almost have an exactly opposite interpretation of that. Because when I read the part where, like, Ruth's husband dies, Orpah's husband died, all that they're really left with and all that they really know so far is their mother-in-law, Naomi. So I thought, like, maybe Orpah's the renegade who's able to carve her own path, and Ruth is just kind of falling apart and clinging to, you know, whatever's closest, whatever she knows, unable to make her own decision. So what do you think, Pat?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that, and I thought of this entire book as, you know, we've already covered the other books about, you know, the Israelites conquering and everything like that and all the weird stuff. This was more of a, like, a coming-of-age tale, and the, you know, like Will said, it's more of a growth story where Ruth is in this dimension of just living life to the fullest, and even though her in-laws are kind of different from one another, and just trying to find a sense of balance in life, it's you could see a mutual commitment within Ruth to establish her own path and seeing what's available.
Yeah, like, she has no idea what's going to happen. Like, as soon as they die, Naomi's like, oh, this is awful. I have nothing to offer you. But Ruth is like, no, you don't get it. Like, I like everything that's going on. I don't know how this story ends, but I've committed to this decision to follow your God and to be a part of your people, and I'm going to see it through, like, 100% commitment. I don't know how it's going to work, but I'm going to make it work. And when they get home, and Naomi has renamed herself to Mara and is like, I'm bitter, and God has forsaken me, and God has killed my children, and I have no life, and God has blah, 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 blah. Ruth is just like, well, we're going to need to eat dinner.
We're gonna need some wheat.
And so she goes out and she gets some food, because it's like, I don't know what's going to happen, but I do know that we need food. And it's like that, and you can interpret it through the God lens and say, you know, that willingness to surrender to God's plan and be out there engaging in the world and with a positive mindset is the only way to receive God's blessings. Or you could call it the universe or the law of attraction. And the fact of the matter is you need to eat food, because if you don't, you don't have energy to expend. And like you're, what is it that Will Smith says? Luck is when opportunity meets preparation. Mm. And so she's prepared. She's getting dinner.
Yeah, you got to create your own luck. You got to adhere to that sense of duty. Like, just like you said, I don't know about any of this other stuff, but I do know we have to eat. And I do know God says it's okay to, you know, go over to your neighbor's field and just pick up what you need. You know, that's why they don't harvest every single stalk. We read about that in Numbers or Leviticus or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm. And it's like Orpah went home to her safety net, because everyone in town knows her. Everyone accepts her. She's not a foreigner in her own land. Whereas Ruth is, like with that one video we watched, probably speaking in an accent, a foreigner, looks different, acts different, doesn't know the behavioral nuances of this society. And she could look at this situation and say, you know, I'm different. I'm an outcast. I'm unworthy. I'm undeserving. I'm not good enough. I'm going to do what Naomi's doing and curl up in a ball and cry. But like, there's no favors for quitters. So I'm just going to go get dinner and put some energy in my belly, because when I'm metabolizing food, I can see things that are in front of me. But when I'm starving, I can't notice what's going on, because all I can think about is survival. And she's not trying to survive. She's thriving in spite. And that's incredible.
Yeah, and just to bring it back to Orpah for a second, I think that you could say that that same sense of duty exists within Orpah too, because she might be thinking, well, I'm going to need a husband. I'm probably not going to find one in Israel or Judah or wherever you're going, so I'm going to have to, you know, make my own way. And I don't see my path and your path converging anymore, so I'm doing what's best for me. You two are doing what you think is best for you two. So, yeah, she just lived out the rest of her life as a Moabite in the land of Moab. Probably nothing significant happens. But when you see Ruth taking that extra step to venture into the land unknown, the promised land even, you know, she becomes one of the most important characters to the whole Christian mythology. Without her and Boaz, there'd be no Jesus or no King David. All the line is, it's all connected here.
Yeah, and another thing too is the fact that Ruth and Naomi are widows. They come from a similar path to one another. And of course, you can see Ruth's commitment throughout the book, saying that she would do anything but depart from Naomi or her family and just go on a path that is clearly not where there's nothing, essentially.
Yeah, there's no landmarks. It's not defined. She doesn't know what her future holds, but to be able to walk that path with strength is quite a lot. But it's interesting, because we have in the first act Orpah disappearing into the histories, and then nearer to the end we have Boaz's relative disappearing into the histories. And I think it's interesting that, you know, Orpah goes home, lives her life, maybe she does something really interesting, but it doesn't show up in this story. And then Boaz's relative too, for the sake of preserving his family name, he is lost to the history.
Yeah. I think there's definitely something there, because I think it was in the last book of Judges, I think it was Abimelech. It does give him his name, but he says something like, I don't want to go down in history as the guy who was slain by a woman with a simple millstone. And then, you know, we read about his story, and that's the only part that I remember from him. You know, like he kills himself afterwards. So because he doesn't want this to be remembered of him. And like, it's like the Oedipal story, you know, the more that you strive to not be something, to be apart from something, the more you just inadvertently head in that direction.
And it's weird that that, go ahead.
I think there's another connection here that, I think it's neat that the Ruth's connection to Boaz and Boaz's relative is through Naomi, who's just, you know, portrays herself as this bitter old woman for the majority of the story, who doesn't want to have anything to do with anybody. She just wants to sit and live out the rest of her life in, you know, misery as a widow. But it's because of her that Ruth, the one who is striding towards something on the hero's journey, that she's able to, you know, find a new family and integrate into the society. So it's through the Mara, who is bitter, that Ruth is able to strive and in the end, like, save Naomi's soul in a way.
And it's probably some sort of toxic codependency between the two, right? Like,
yeah.
Obviously, you can look at it through that lens and you can say, you know what, Ruth has got something that happened to her that broke her, that she needs to be with a woman who isn't doing the motherly role. And it's like, so Ruth is now positioning herself as the matriarch of the family because she's the one that's doing stuff. She's the one that's bringing home food. She's the one that's getting married. And it isn't until Naomi or Mara really actually notices the full extent of the likelihood that this is going to work out in their favor that she starts to actually get excited and start to act like a girl and like a friend to Ruth. Not a mother, not really. Right. They just kind of conspire and entrap Boaz. But it's weird because on the one hand, you've got that whole self-fulfilling prophecy thing where it's like the more you resist something, the likelier you are to get to it. But then there's this, like, there's no prophecy. You've got bitterness and hope, and they balance each other out. And in the long run, it turns into just sort of greatness between the two of them. And there's something to unpack there that would work because there's so many more reasons and outcomes that are more likely when you have someone who's bitter and someone who's codependent with someone who's bitter. It's much more likely that they just destroy themselves.
Yeah, and dependency can be rather toxic too.
Oh yeah.
It can lead to just controlling somebody or just even self-control where you just let it influence you to the point where you don't even understand yourself or even know how you came to this situation you are now.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
And there's also I think it's in chapter 3 where it's the book mentions the six measures. Did any of you come across that?
I mean, yes, but I don't recall it.
I just noticed this. There's one quote here. It says, again, he said, give me the cloak that is on you and hold it. So she held it and measured six measures of barley and laid it on her. Then she went to the city. I don't know if that...
It just seems like an arbitrary number, but I'm sure there's more to it.
I think it's just probably the amount of barley she collected, perhaps. I thought it was something more metaphorical there, but not sure.
I think it was probably just like, here's a whole bunch of barley because you're family and this is as much as you can hold. But
maybe it has something to do with like a... You know, the 6 days of gathering and then the Sabbath. You have enough for 6 days and then come back and... I don't know, man.
One of those things where, like, I think you could probably read into almost every phrase of the Bible. Like, I just typed in six measures of barley and there's a blog called Six Measures of Barley about the time that Boaz gave Ruth six measures of barley, and it was a meaningful thing for them.
Yeah, it just says, and go not empty-handed unto thy mother-in-law. So, like, you need at least six measures to be impressed.
I don't know.
I guess so.
It's weird, you know, like when we're doing a podcast about a 4-page section of this 2,800-page Bible, and I'm not Christian, I'm not Jewish, I'm not even religious. I'm spiritual. I'm faithful. I'm hopeful, but I'm not trying to disseminate the word of God to the internet. And so The question comes back to, if we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater and Ruth is the baby right now, what's the big takeaway?
Well, it's essentially for me, that.
Yeah.
It's essentially that. Don't leave everything out. Just look at each one, analyze it, and come up with your own conclusions. I thought this was more of a coming of age tale, and it seems as though this genre is very popular amongst all ages, I would say, because it just explores various parts of life that many people may not have experienced but are genuinely curious about, or maybe they can relate to it, and or maybe they have a large family with some siblings who are, on one hand, having trouble trying to get away from this childlike world and is having trouble getting into the real world, and they have to rely on an older sibling to help them.
Like, kind of like a don't be afraid to ask for help kind of thing. And there's always going to be someone there to help you. Just in the relationship with Ruth and Naomi, like, they kind of have to stick together. Because what would have happened to Naomi if Ruth didn't come with her? She might not have even made it to Bethlehem, Judah, or wherever they were heading.
Right.
So. Yeah. Yeah, I think for me it's just that simple thing, that growth mindset of, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm going to need to eat breakfast.
Yeah. And I always go ahead.
Well, and then there's also that choice, right? Like, because, I mean, Orpah, like, you don't hear about her dying in some sort of terrible way, but you do hear about Ruth. But I think they both made a choice, and they both committed to that choice. And it's not about what choice you make, but making a choice. And Naomi doesn't. And that's the thing to stay away from. And Ruth or Orpah would be the thing to go towards, which is do something, do it intentionally, and make sure you eat food.
Yeah. That last part is huge, but I like everything you said there. But yeah, I like to look at just the historical meaning of it, because, you know, once you start reading about a single book of the Bible, there really is no finishing reading about that book of the Bible. So, like, you start learning about all of what the names mean, like the two guys, like Orpah's and Ruth's husbands, their names were literally translated into sickness and wasting or puny or something like that. Like, it tells you right away, these guys aren't long for this world.
Yeah.
And you know, in the Jewish tradition, this book is considered much more just literature, whereas in the Christian tradition, it's much more historical, because, well, they need it to be historical, because Ruth is an ancestor of Jesus, their savior. So, you know, if this wasn't historical, then their whole scripture falls apart, or at least starts to fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's frustrating to see that all of these books have some sort of tie-in to Christ, and that the first thing that you get to on the internet when you say, what is Ruth about, is, oh, it's actually a metaphor for Jesus. And it's like, well, yeah, but before that, you know, like, for the I don't know, 1,000 years before he was born, what did this book mean?
Yeah.
Because it didn't mean that before he came and before he was prophesied for of coming. That was not the point.
You could make the case that it's a metaphor for King David, because I mean a lot of the Old Testament is leading up towards, you know, the first king in Israel, but to say that all leads to Jesus is just kind of, well, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but it seems like you're kind of smuggling this little baby Jesus in wherever you can.
Yeah, and you're undermining hundreds of years of things and content and context and struggle and strife and lessons and trivialities. And it's like, you can't just say, oh, don't worry, it's all about Jesus. Like, there's 2,300 pages here that have nothing to do with Jesus until you tell me that they're all related to him. And it's like while they're alive and while they're writing these stories, there's something completely different going on.
Yeah, and you can't just leave the names there and just say, you know, okay, these are the people. Okay, let's move on to Jesus. You have to explain why they're there, why they're important. And Scott, before we recorded, you and I were talking about your, you were drawing some characters and yes.
My comic and project.
Yeah, and we were talking about like shared universes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That kind of conversation that we're having right now just reminds me of that.
Oh, yeah. I think about it all the time. Just like, you know, we could make the easiest comparison to, you know, Spider-Man. Like the first 30-something issues were created by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. You could call those the Masoretic text, you know. And then everything else was after that, you know. Then you get to the writings of Joshua when the next guy takes over. And, you know, the next guy takes over, and then the next guy takes over. You have all of your prophets writing this story, but it's all about the same thing. But it's like some guy coming along in the year 2020 and saying, oh, no, Spider-Man is actually all about
Black
this.
And gay.
it's not about great power coming with great great responsibility coming with great power. It's all about, you know, Black Lives Mattering and LGBTQ mattering. Rights. You know, it's a poor example, but, you know, it's basically the exact same thing that I see. You can't just take the thing at the end and say, well, Spider-Man's always been about this.
Well, it's like, I was just reading up on, I don't know if you saw the trailer for the Enola Holmes series with Millie Bobby Brown, but I guess 20 years ago, this woman decided that she was going to write a whole bunch of stories about Sherlock Holmes, 20 years his junior, younger sister, Enola Holmes. And so there's a lawsuit against Netflix and this author and the publishing house because they're like half of the books are public domain, but after the Great War, when Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's son died, he gave Sherlock emotions, and those stories are not in the public domain, and the estate of Arthur Conan Doyle still has copyright claim to him. And Enola Holmes has portrayed Sherlock as being respecting of women and having compassion, traits that did not appear until the 1920s after Sir Arthur Conan Doyle experienced loss. And so to write a story about Holmes in the realm of him respecting women and caring about humans is a copyright infringement. And so, and they've come along 80 to 100 years after an author has written a bunch of stories. And they said, actually, we prefer the character nearer the end. And he has a sister and he's nice to her. And we're going to just add to your universe and create other characters. And it's like, what are you doing?
See, this
it's
is why
your book.
See, this is why you should always protect your creative processes. Almost like signing a will of testament, last will and testament. You have to follow the wishes of a person who's dying on their deathbed. You cannot change it, you cannot throw it out and create something new of it. You can't do that. You have to respect the wishes. of someone.
And I think that's probably where the Jews went wrong. They should have gone, our God, TM, copyright, case closed.
No other scripture is allowed to use our characters. These are our characters. 2,000 years before Image Comics.
Yeah, you can't just say, oh yes, I agree with all of you, but then everything changes in the next act. So get out of here, M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah. But like, yeah, I don't know where I really stand on the whole like public domain thing, because you know, some characters are obvious. Like, you could write a story about Thor or Achilles or Hector. They're all in the public domain. No one owns Odin or Wotan. It's just
sure.
You're allowed
just
to
don't tell.
You're allowed to make those characters in your stories. That's why Jack Kirby's Mighty Thor run was so successful.
Yeah, but just don't tell me that your Thor, whom you've created, has a friend named Tony who's a philanthropist billionaire engineer. Because guess what? That's not the story of Thor. That's the story of Thor, Marvel, TM, copyright.
Yeah, but it's like a, I don't know, man. It's not saying, oh yeah, Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes comes to the future and now that exact same character is now in our universe. It's like we have a character inspired by that character who we just call Sherlock Holmes for the fun of it.
I don't know, just like maybe give them new names, right? Like if you want to be inspired, but like let's not confuse inspiration with plagiarization.
That's my problem with like all of these, you know, remakes that they keep booting up with like all female casts. Just like, no, you're being insulting to the writers and the actors and the creators by saying you cannot create something without throwing the James Bond tag to it or,
yeah,
you know, whatever, like Ghostbusters. You're not going to be able to be successful unless we attach the Ghostbusters label to it. You need this brand. But like,
yeah. Like, when Doctor Who decided to turn into a woman, that was fine and fair and expected because
that's in the lore already.
The Gallifreyans can turn into women. That's totally acceptable. They can manifest in any form during a rebirth. When they gave him 13 more rebirths so that they could make him a woman, that was wrong. Because he was supposed to die and the series was supposed to end, and they said, screw that, let's make a sequel that's just as long as the first 70 years.
Yeah, and just like how...
Make a new show!
Just like how the Bible was supposed to end with the 12 prophets at the end, it wasn't supposed to continue on with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It had an ending.
and the thing like I'm sure... that I'm starting... Go ahead.
I'm sure that'll be something that we can add to a Wavecast, like this whole continuation and everything like that. But yeah, it just going back to Ruth. Yeah, it's just you can't just add names and then just say they just existed for no reason and then come in Jesus walks in. I think it's actually you could say that. Maybe this is a bit of foreshadowing for Jesus coming. What do you think about that?
Well, in order to have foreshadowing, you need to know the ending before you actually write it.
So yes.
That fits in perfectly with what I believe about the Bible being a narrative and a story about how you make it to the end, then you rewrite it again to make it look like it was all leading up to one big end and one huge climax.
And that's like the big problem we're going to keep running into.
It doesn't read like a history book at all. It has like historical events, but when I'm reading this, it's not like someone's trying to explain history to me. I feel like someone's telling me a story. So that's where the hang up is for me.
Well, and it would be interesting to know what it felt like to read these stories in like Greek or Hebrew.
Right.
Because, like, sure, the King James version of the Holy Bible feels like there's a lot of foreshadow and leading up to, and no mention of Yahweh. So, like, how much is that because of the story, and how much of that is because of the editor?
Yeah.
I don't know. Gotta be skeptic. Gotta not take it too literally. Gotta try and find the meaning for you. And if it's not meaningful, fine. But don't not read it and tell me it's not meaningful. Because,
right.
Yeah, it's a 4-page story. It's not revolutionized my life. And I'm glad I read it. Because by the time I'm done this book, I'll be one of the 1% of North Americans who can confidently say I've read the Bible.
Yes. And I've taken the time to, you know, try to interpret what it actually means, not just read one verse out of one book and says, I know what Jesus wants from me now.
Yeah, like I'm not saying we need the Bible. I'm not saying we need Jesus. I'm not saying we need Christ. I'm saying we used the Bible and we used Jesus and we used religion in the past 2,000 years, and it got us to here. And maybe if we read it, like, maybe there's some value in the manual, right?
Yeah, I know I've brought this up before, but, like, to any Christians who think that, like, comparing the Bible to a Spider-Man comic is insulting, you have no idea how seriously I take Spider-Man. Like, yeah. Narrative and story is important. It's how we find meaning in the universe. And without it, we wouldn't be the humans that we are today. We wouldn't have become what we've become without narrative, and the Bible is one of the biggest narratives that we have, period.
And if you think that the comparison between the Bible and Spider-Man is insulting, you have a limiting belief. Like,
right.
I was describing this show that I watched with my wife to my father last night, and I described the entire show and the whole plot of it, and he said, oh, that's really interesting. What's it called? And I said, it's called whatever, but you won't like it. It's an anime. And he's like, oh yeah, you're right. Like, so because of the medium, you can't engage. And it's like, without a $1 billion to $1 trillion budget, these people can fly all over the world and tell stories in rapid fire. There's a word that means it comes next.
Succession.
Yeah. Without spending a dime on travel budget, because you're drawing it. And it's like, so because there's no real people in it, it doesn't make it meaningful. Meanwhile, there's billions of live action movies that are meaningless. So to discount entire medium just because of the medium, that's just arbitrary and absurd.
Yeah. I think we should have a wavecast going into more discussions like that, and then bring examples of entertainment medium, like in movies, yeah, anime. Yeah. We could definitely do that.
Bring up
that.
One of our favorite philosophers, Marshall McLuhan, who said the medium is the message. And it's easy to write something off as being like, oh, it's a children's show, I'm not going to watch that. Or, you know, that book's too long, too highbrow for me, that's not my speed. But, like, it's not until you start to take those steps into the unknown where you realize, you know, the kind of literature that you actually do appreciate and the mediums that, you know, you best understand. Like, I read comics a lot more than I read books because, you know, I like the art. I like the progression of it, whatever. Graphic novels, they're fun for me, so that's what I do. But, like, whenever I'm reading just a plain old page, it's completely different. And then contrast that to a live-action show or an anime. It's like, well, of course it's going to be a different experience, but you can learn to appreciate that form of art, too. And that's exactly what Ruth did, was she learned to appreciate another culture and she learned to thrive within it. She wasn't closed-minded and she was open. She's open-minded enough to, you know, take on the world and accept it the way it is. Learn from everybody, yeah, not just the Moabites back home.
I think that's the perfect note to end on.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, until next time. Check us out at our website, www.bookwave.club, and may the force be with you.
or equal to mass times acceleration.
Poof, poof.